Matrix. I'm Jonathan, and I'm left of center.
And I'm Rich, and I tend to lean a little bit more to the right. But the bottom line is together we try to look for the balance of what it means to be human in today's world.
All right, let's get started, everyone. Welcome to Living in the Matrix. I'm Jonathan, and this is my co-host, Rich. Say hello, Rich.
Hey, everybody. Great to be back. It seems like it's been a couple of weeks, and a lot has taken place since then. But happy to have our guest today.
Yeah. We've had some interesting moments. We should have a topics episode pretty soon here because it's things are brewing. A lot of stuff, interesting stuff is happening. But we have an absolutely fantastic guest today. Her name is Ariel Lanning. And Ariel is a deconstruction coach, helping people deconstruct from their Christian faith to find their intuition, overcoming their fear, and taking their lives back. I love that idea. Welcome, Ariel.
Thank you. And thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here and talking with you guys.
Yeah. So I found you on Instagram and you immediately caught my attention because you took in the three first videos that I ever saw, you took a very hard approach to this is spiritual trauma and it's abusive. For people who have lived sort of the traditional evangelical faith. That's a hard line, but I want to listen to that because I think having known a little bit about your story comes from personal experience, and I want to open up the space here for you to sort of help us unpack your big idea that you talk a lot about on Instagram.
Sure. Thank you for that introduction. Honestly, it was a very long time coming and opening, a very devout Christian faith of myself, and then learning more and more about the human body and what could not work, what the two concepts that would contradict each other. So my goal now is to help people understand that they can have spirituality without the rules and without the constructs and without the foundations that are toxic and go against human nature and adopt what does work with them and move forward, and also have psychology, neuroscience, physiology, and quantum physics support certain realms of spirituality. So You can have the science and the heart. You can have the somatics and the analytical. You just have to find where they can come together and they don't contradict each other. And coming from an upbringing that was Mormon, LDS, Latter-day Saints, which is Christian, people often like to just try to say that it isn't, but the church is called the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So we believe in the Bible, but also not we. Past we believed in the Bible and then also the addition of the Book of Mormon. And so we did follow Jesus Christ. But as I started studying my journey and the concepts that really held near and dear to me, the contradiction started rewriting my beliefs. And then I would try to find healing modalities that helped me heal the subconscious part, because I could know on a cognitive level what I no longer agreed with, but I could not help my subconscious and tissues follow along until I did certain work.
So what I hear you saying, because I know a lot about what you're talking about, especially the quantum physics and the neuroscience around it, you essentially realized you couldn't change until you did something in your body. It wasn't just here, it was also here. And I completely agree with that. I think that's the awakening that is happening now. A lot of people are realizing theology lives primarily up here, and the way of most religions is focus on the theology and the right way of thinking, and your body will automatically follow along. And that's not true. Your body is based on scripts, and you have to change your body. And you found that out. Tell me a little bit about how, well, first I want to go back and ask, you have a unique story. You were a devout Christian in the Latter-day Saints. What were the contradictions that kind of began the journey for you to go, why would you even deconstruct?
Well, the contradictions didn't become blatant until I began a yoga teacher training because I started yoga after I had my daughter. But some of the things that happened up until then started unraveling, because when you start yoga and you start somatic work, you start healing things from your past that you didn't know were still tagging along for the journey. So a couple of the things that I went through that were probably the most...
Interruption. Was there a particular type of yoga that helped you with that? Because I mean, there's this idea of yoga where a lot of people are, I'm doing it for stretching and exercise and limberness. But then if you look at the Bhagavad Gita and you look at other kinds of yoga, there's actually deep spiritual paths in the yoga. Was there a particular element that your instructor was helping you with for our audience? Because we've had both kinds. Yeah.
Well, honestly, my yoga instructor is trained in the Eastern philosophies. And so, and she's also has a biology background. So her majors in college were biology. And she lives in a conservative town. We live in North Texas. So she approached it from a very scientific aspect to make sure that it was obtainable and touchable for our community. And only once you've known her for a very long time will you start getting any more of I like the word magic sometimes, but the woo-woo, you know, people like to, that from her, but you won't really get, yeah, she ties it all in so naturally, and she grounds it into our humanity with such a foundation in science and her Eastern premise. So everything she does, it makes yoga, like we're all about modifications and breath work and conscious breathing, and it's very far from the Western yoga that if I go to a Western yoga class, I'm really thrown, like, cause I've only been studying primarily from her for years and I stay with her because of it. So I wouldn't say it's a type of yoga. I would say it was Eastern, but we still did all kinds, like Hatha, Yin. It doesn't really, they all help in that aspect. Just depends on the teacher.
Were you going to her as a coach or a somatic practitioner?
So I've seen her as both, but she owns the yoga studio in my town, and I also did all my yoga teacher trainings under her. So I've been studying under her since 2018 or 19. So that's the kind of yoga background. That's before that, I started with yoga with Adrian on YouTube.
So back to my question about what were those sense of things that didn't make sense? Help us understand what those were.
When I was 19, I had a high school sweetheart of 4 years, and he was not religious, but we had fallen off the path of my Christianity because we fell into poverty. And so my parents' mental health fell, and mine did as well, along with my siblings. But I was the oldest, so I got out of the house the quickest and was on my own and had 3 jobs. I was in community college and working as a model and singer and, you know, doing all the things I could do to be a young, successful adult. And then I had a crush on a female that I met, and I could not deny it. And I finally realized that I had language for it. Even though I had crushes when I was younger, there was no vocabulary. It was just this untouchable thing that I learned to fragment. I learned to like shut the doors and compartmentalize these aspects of myself into a way that like they didn't exist. And then when I realized that I had this thing I could not deny, when I left him for her, I left every healthy thing that I had as in place, because since I had this subconscious belief that I was this unworthy sinner, when I stepped into that role, I embodied it entirely and stepped into a lifestyle of complete chaotic, unhealthy dynamics in any aspect. I dropped my college. I lost my jobs. I moved in with my girlfriend, you know, drank ridiculous amounts for about 2.5 years. I really lost myself, and in a depression as well. And then that boyfriend committed suicide, and then the guilt toppled, and I became like deathly ill. I would say I lost 50 pounds in a couple of months and developed allergies to all the basic ingredients like wheat, corn, dairy, scallops. There was a couple others, but I couldn't eat anything. And I got pregnant with my daughter, and the pregnancy saved my life. And so then once I had her, I was like, okay, well, I got to figure out how to be a healthy person for this little person. And so I started yoga. And that's where mindsets started to really reset themselves and reorganize them. And I could feel the pain without becoming them and understand that his choices were not my fault. And he didn't pass away because I chose to date a female and explore who I was as a human being. So that's one of the aspects that really had me turning around in circles when I was debating whether self-love was this concept that I could approach and actually embody, or if self-love was kind of this selfish thing that at least the Christianity around me was preaching was not of God. You know, we were, he's first, I am second, that kind of thing. And in order to heal the self, it had to be a rewiring of the internal narrator to be the parent that was the most loving parent you can ever imagine, and really set your boundaries and honor the self. And I had to learn that that was okay to do.
Yeah. Wow. That is some powerful stuff there, Ariel. I mean, I'm just so much going on. In one of your reels, you talked about the dangers of purity culture. And we've seen in the evangelical side of things, a guy named Josh Harris, who wrote a book called Kiss Dating Goodbye. You might've heard of that book, but he actually basically looked back and I think he not only divorced his wife, but he basically said, I lied. This is a terrible thing. It was for the books. It was a joke. It was not true. Tell us what you tell, you know, help the audience understand what the damages that you saw from purity culture and what we can probably do to help change that. It seems like it's lost the favor that it had, let's say 10, 15 years ago, because everybody had the purity rings, you know, and there was such pressure, right? And you could just see the people breaking. So what in your mind is the trajectory, and what are the underlying, you know, pain and suffering that come from it? And then what do we do to get out of that kind of mindset to get to a healthier place in your mind?
With purity culture, I think it's unhealthy for both males and females. And to start off with the idea that so many young men, especially in the LDS church, are really preached to that they're fulfillment is based off of finding this person who will make their home everything they've ever dreamed of and fulfill the wishes of God, and that it's God's wish to have as many children as possible, and that is how you make heaven on earth. And it puts such an unreachable goal of happiness on this responsibility of another individual, and actually removes their power of actually finding their soul purpose and passion that could fulfill them in so many more ways than a relationship, because relationships don't make us whole. I also think that puts a lot of it projects into a lot of resentment, because once you do find, if that's your goal, is the ideal subservient, pure, in quotations, woman, and you think you've accomplished that, and then you're still not happy because there's so many other aspects of life that need to be managed in order for, you know, a gradual, even state of balance in life. And once they realize they can't have it through her, there's a resentment, and they don't understand always that, and I hate saying like everyone, but it's a large group of what I'm observing, that it's not her responsibility and that there's nothing wrong with their relationship, but maybe there's something else unfulfilled within them that they could go find. And a lot of times in Christian counseling, it's turn to God more, pray to God more. A lot of advice that doesn't actually help with reestablishing the missing pieces that usually come from the upbringing. And then on the other side of it, you have women with so much repressed sexual shame from being told, specifically in LDS as well, is that we're responsible for men's reactions to our skin and that they can't control their thoughts. Once you reveal an out, like some skin, it's your responsibility to monitor their. So then you have a resentment of your carrying, you're carrying all of their, their reactions. It's on you, right? The kind of the, we talk about that one all the time but it, not only that, but there's so much shame associated with holding this thing that could potentially be the downfall of another thing, that then the sexual chakra, the second chakra, is actually suppressed energetically. And we can't even be the embodied sexual human beings we would want to be at our best with our, even our one partner, if we were in a monogamous Christian relationship, because there is so much shame associated with the women and the female anatomy that there is no embodiment, especially in the bedroom. So you have two aspects looking for, well, somebody, they just have these expectations that are unobtainable with the preliminary or the building up of the mindsets. If I rounded that about the way I wanted to.
You go back to, you've mentioned several times this idea of loving yourself. And what I heard is, because I experienced this as well, is within the Christian culture, it's never the idea of love yourself, it's the idea of deny yourself. And I think denying yourself is the fullest embodiment of loving yourself, but loving yourself has to come first in order to understand why to deny yourself. So if you, how hard was it for you to look? Because I've struggled with this. I think this is one of the central questions of all human beings, is it's hard to learn to love yourself. It's easier to just ignore it. What was that journey like for you to really begin to say, oh, loving myself, not denying myself, but loving myself? What was that like? What'd you feel?
That was a very gradual process, an unraveling. And it didn't come full circle, full opening until I opened a very huge trauma from childhood. So if I want to preface this with a little trigger warning, I've been working on self-love and fixing the inner narrator, because there's a big shame, you know, spiral. If I mess up, oh, of course you did. Of course, this is your luck. This is how things happen for you. This like kind of shame.
It's the unworthy script.
And an unworthy script. And so I've been working on reparenting that inner voice, like, it's okay, you know, it's not a big deal. We'll pick it up. It's not a big mess. We're only 2 minutes late. And last year in EMDR therapy, I was working on what I thought was religious trauma. And we started at my baptism, because that's what was coming up. And so in the memory, I'm walking into the tub and I can remember where everybody is, the white, the man that's going to baptize me. And I'm feeling at age 8, because that's when you got baptized in LDS, that the tub is going to like turn red, or that Jesus or God is going to just announce from the skies that I should not be getting baptized. Like this thunderous voice was going to like boom in. And so me and my therapists are like, well, that's a very big fear for an 8-year-old. Like, what could you have possibly done? So we had to go further into the body and ask. And then I was in my childhood playhouse that I hadn't visualized in, or even seen in 25 years, and with a foreign hand on my thighs. So we opened an essay, a childhood essay from age 4, that I had repressed, and it was a reoccurring incident, so it happened more than once. And because of the repressed memory, I did not feel like I should have even been baptized. And I had all this shame, thinking like I was going to be found out, since I guess age 4. So once that happened last year, My mom actually denied it and said that I was a liar to my siblings. And I had to learn to be my own support team. You know, I had my therapist and I had a couple of best friends, but therapists are expensive and it's a very heavy process to remember that bit by bit and accept it and hold it. And so in having to learn how to hold fractioned four-year-old me who had went into hiding when that happened, I really regained the ability to talk to myself as I would want to speak to a child now.
What happened to you by learning with that? That's an amazing tool to be able to speak to yourself as a child. How did that help you?
Instead of speaking to myself like I was this shameful, angry teenager, which I guess is the voice that was kind of internalized all this time, and full of suppressed anger and rage for these things that I hadn't been able to hold spaciously with love. Finally being able to, I couldn't even ever see myself as a child until I found her, and then being able to see that child and know that she was worth the same grace as my own child.
Wow, that's some deep stuff. You're literally not able to experience what it actually should be like for every young child because of that trauma was pushed back there. One of the people I've been studying a little bit lately is Carl Jung. He's a very famous psychoanalyst. He was out there doing Freud, and I like him better because he didn't make everything sexual, even though sexuality was a big part of it. Freud was definitely, sexuality is the root of all, you know, mal behaviors. But can you give us some examples of some particular things that you did to help pull that back? Because what Jung would do, he would go through dreams, right? He would do dream analysis, right? And they would tell these stories and go, and some of them didn't make any sense at all until he dug a little bit deeper and then he found some extraneous circumstances. So what in those particular practices were you doing? Behaviors, actions, you know, thoughts, meditations that helped find that childhood and what, you know, what did you actually do? Can you explain that or is it hard to describe?
So are you talking, this would be the EMDR practice specifically?
Yes.
Then?
I'm sorry. Yeah. I should have asked it because I'm not familiar with that term.
Oh, that's okay.
We could flesh that out then. Help us understand what that was.
So much like a lot of work with either somatic exploration, which you would kind of follow in your own experience, or even what I've studied in clairvoyant healing, is you follow these sensations that have symbolisms and open up for different meanings. But in EMDR, you're very in the somatic experience. So especially with a childhood SA, there's a big chance that your eyes were closed. So there isn't always a visual that starts off there. But so we follow the discomfort. And a lot of people struggle sitting with discomfort. That's why it is sometimes very difficult to begin these processes. And so with the images that I did have, that's where it was our access point, is what she would call it. So I had the memories and the visuals from the baptism. But I mean, we didn't know we were opening the child essay until we were there. And so you kind of go into what you remember and follow along. And it's very much like a sentience. Like I kind of have forgotten all the dynamics, but once you're in it, you're like, oh, I'm in the tub facing this way and the audience is to the right. Everybody's ground level. They can kind of see me. There is a man here. I can feel an arm and an arm here and an arm here. Oh, that's where his hands were. I can see the visual now. I forgot they did it that way. I can feel the slippery tub. I feel fear, like my heart's pounding out of my chest. And then she would say, okay, can we go into that? So I would take a deep breath and prepare to do so. And I would follow the fear in my chest. And she would say, if it doesn't have a color, a texture, and we might explain it that way. And then instead of explaining it as an emotion, we'd explain it as tightening, as if someone's pushing on my chest. And then we would dive it in and breathe into it. And I like to explain it like it's a helix ball, you know, they kind of like the toys that open and close, as I kind of feel it that way. And it opens. And when you breathe into it and stay with it and you bring the awareness, it continues to open. And every emotion only lasts chemically for 90 seconds. So if you can stay with the trapped emotion for 90 seconds without adding on new emotions with thought process, you can process through that emotion and release it from the tissues. So we'll stay with that emotion. And then it kind of might dissipate and something new might come up. And then she's like, what are you feeling now? Now I feel this sensation. And so we would follow it bit by bit, deeper and deeper into the essay and then the details of all the things that happened and to 4-year-old me.
Yeah. I mean, this is where I think, Jonathan, this is where the unified field and, you know, this is where we're seeing the melding of things, right? Of physiology and time, right? This is the kind of stuff that is really fascinating for us, because the more we tap into this, I mean, what you just described is a nonlinear time experience, right? That you literally are, it happened, you forgot it, but yet it's still here brought to the front. So it's almost like you're right there. And we've got a guy we like named Dr. Joe Dispenza. He got to go back to his baby, right? And he's like looking over him, right? And he had these fever dreams that he relished, right? And it's like, this is the kind of stuff that is fascinating. And this is amazing. It's terrible that what you had to go through, but what you're describing is so powerful for future, you know, for people who are suffering. I mean, talk about a good demographic to have, people who have gone through trauma, who've deconstructed from Christianity. That you've got a very big open audience. I can tell you that right now. There's a lot of people that are hurting right now that could definitely take advantage of listening to this podcast.
So. Well, I think we've been taught our entire lives, especially in the Christian tradition, that we're really supposed to look to the pastor, you know, to be our guide and our teacher. And, you know, if those bounds are ever crossed, but it's, for the most part, we live a passive experience. And what I love about Ariel's story and your process, because it sounds like a lot of somatic practices that I've experienced in the past, is we're learning that human beings can heal themselves. Because I had a very similar experience in February, Ariel, or in March. I went to Hawaii and I sat with myself at a location that my 11-year-old self was basically lost because his parents just got divorced. And I was there for the first time in 25 years and I go, oh my God, I've got undone work. And I sat with myself and I just sat there and cried with myself. And it was one of the most healing experiences. And it was very helpful that I was there. I always suggest people go back to the scene of the crime, because it's the easiest way to release a lot of the energy again. And I did that and I realized I have a big hand in healing myself. I have that capacity. And that's what I love about your story, Ariel, is that you're taking responsibility for yourself and saying, wait, something isn't working. I am this person. I want to figure it out, but I want to learn how to love myself. And so getting through that journey of really going back and taking care a lot of that negative energy, what was the fruit of that? What happened after that? Because a lot of people are afraid to really do work because they're afraid of what will happen after that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Of which thing specifically?
Well, you have this EMDR experience.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel a sense of release from that?
Or was it
a continual? Yeah. Because I've had those where they're a deep sense of release. Sounds like it was for you too.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I feel like it was probably a 6-month process of sitting in it, because I went to therapy every other week, and every other week we'd open up a little bit more details. And then I knew who it was. And then I knew the words that were said. And then I knew the next time it happened, and I knew why I did this. And each bit of it processing while being called a liar from somebody who had been my best friend my whole life was really heavy. And I was very much in the cocoon for a while, but And you know, I've heard some people say, well, oh, I just leave it there. I want nothing to do with it. And I'm like, oh, no, no, no. I mean, I understand everything now. And I can feel things on such a next level, especially in different aspects of my life. And I found a piece of me that was lost. And in finding this piece of me, I was able to then find the next piece of me that was lost and fragmented. And it explained so many things. It's just like click, 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 click. I wouldn't change it for the world. I'm so grateful that it came out. And actually, I thought it was the perfect timing because I was on this mission to learn to teach my body that it could trust itself last year. And I finally let it finally trusted me enough to open that for me. So, and allow me to see it and hold it with compassion. So I felt like I had really accomplished something that I'd finally deserved to know and about this information and to hold it in a compassionate way.
Yeah. Ariel, do you think that there's healthy examples of Christianity out there? I mean, I love Jesus, you know, that's my deal. I think he's amazing. I think that the church has caused lots of pain and hierarchical power. Jonathan and I are actually leaning strongly towards universalism where everybody will be reconciled to God at the end. That might not be attractive to you, but the idea of having a hell and people to die and last there forever is a really powerful kind of compelling event to actually join the fold. And if you take that away, for instance, which some of the early church believers, you know, believe that, hey, God's going to take care of everybody at the end because man's stupidity isn't greater than God's love, right? I guess what I'm trying to get at is, do you believe that the apostles and Jesus had a good message? And do you believe that there's healthy church communities out there today? Or do you think it's all just a big lie?
I believe that Jesus had a good message, and I believe that there was more to Jesus than what is allowed in the Bible. I have heard of books removed where he does speak on the type of love that I believe in now. I have seen Jesus in meditation, and he said, "Forgive me for what they've done in my name." I don't link Jesus with Christianity. I believe Christianity is what was made of his love when mankind tried to conceptualize something that could not be conceptualized. And since it was done so long ago, I believe that their intellectual levels infiltrated that and also therefore kind of stunted spirituality and its ability to flourish because of the rules and concepts in the box that they put on something that was ungraspable. So to say, can we have a healthy Christianity? Well, the foundation of Christianity believes that in the concept of sinners and that Jesus died for your sins. And so in that aspect, I do not agree and I do not believe, because in that aspect, you have to believe that we were born inherently bad, and I don't agree with that. And the concept of that actually impairs our cognitive thinking mind and the what we think about ourselves, and that has to be something we heal and fix later in life in order to touch all the aspects that make us total now. But if you separate Jesus and Christianity, and if Jesus was just Jesus in his own spiritual name, then yes, I can love Jesus. I do love Jesus.
Yeah, of course.
So because you have such a Christian background, does the cross mean anything to you? Doesn't have to be religious, but does it have any meaning now for you?
Mormons don't actually wear crosses, but it actually somatically hurts my heart when I hear it or visualize it. And I think it's because of how much healing work I've done. There is this, I just feel the pain of the incident and the betrayal and the actual pain. Like, it's just a horrific thing. And so I see it as like, as if you were watching a horror movie. It's almost like it just makes my heart ache.
Just so you know, Ariel, I actually wrote a book in 2010 called Discovering the God Imagination that did say exactly what you said, which is we got it wrong in the garden. God never lost touch with good, ever. It's human beings that did. And so what the cross is, the reason why I ask about the cross is Jesus saying, okay, I'm God. This is how far I will go to let you realize I still love you no matter what. There is no disconnection. It's all somatic. It happens in the brain, in the amygdala that cuts you off from the default mode network, and you're disconnected from your God self. And I wrote a whole book on it because we got it wrong. We did. We got it wrong. Evangelical Christianity got it wrong. And if you begin with the idea that God's declaration in Genesis 1, seven times, it is good, it is good, it is good. It's not about the creation. It's about the judgment. So God, and then we get to a point where there's this tree that asks one question of duality. Are you good or evil? Well, God's already given you seven times you're good, and then they get it wrong. That's the story. So it's human beings recovering from ourselves. So I want you to know, I think you're spot on. And I think that's your heart listening to somatically going, yeah, the cross was a screwed up situation. But it did reveal the nature of grace. That's the one value of it that I think is undeniable, is that it's basically proving the reality that grace is how the world, the system operates.
Yeah. And I think he did it because nothing else was working, right? I mean, you've gone through cycles and cycles and cycles of violence and recapitulation. And no matter what happened, no matter how many miracles happened, it was just the same old thing. And it's all about politics and it's all about power. And he's like, I'm doing this for you, not you for me, right? I'm trying to show a way here. So,
My theory is the first 6,000 or the last 6,000 years, in essence, around that amount of time, we've lived in a masculine age. And the poles have flipped and we are beginning a feminine age, because what the feminine does is it connects to the body somatically. The masculine is all up here and the feminine is saying, okay, we need balance because things are way out of whack and it's been so far out of whack forever and we're shifting. And that's why I think people like you are standing up, because the poles are shifting. We need a feminine balance to this ridiculous sense of masculinity that has dominated capitalism, history, religions. All religions are started by men, you know? So it's a shift. That's why I wanted to bring you on, Ariel, is because I think you have a great story. But one of the things that I love about your videos is that you have this almost mama heart that comes out in them. You're like, I always said, if there's anybody in hell, the first people that are going there after we die are mothers. And I sense that in you, because you have this strong sense of, fuck you, we're worth more than that. So thank you for your videos.
Thanks. I like that. It's a dark feminine embodiment.
That's Mama Bear. Mama Bear is saying, I'm going to do whatever it takes.
Yeah. But, you know, Jonathan, you just brought up something else so interesting, is that women are trying so hard to be men in the leadership role, right? Women are trying to be the patriarchal roles, and they're not tapping into the power that they have with their own. And we need to appreciate what the divine feminine, what that true strength of the feminine is, and let that be a leader. And that's why it was always in priestesses, right? That's why it could be that men founded all religions, but there's a lot of strong female leaders across a lot of indigenous places where they are the badass in the neighborhood.
They're always better leaders.
Yeah, they keep the peace. They have the structure. They're better organized. There's a lot more going on right there. And I think what we have today, like in the United States, is we've got people who are being inauthentically female. They're trying to say, I can swear and be all the, and I can say all the things and do all the things, and I can make it look like I'm the man that's supposed to be there.
I want to shift gears a little bit and ask, Ariel, does the Church of Latter-day Saints have a strong concept of hell, or is it sort of in the background?
Actually, it's much different than the mainstream concept of hell. They have three different kingdoms. So there's not so much a fiery pit of hell with Satan, but this like waiting place where you can go, but you don't get to be with the baptized top level Mormons.
Yeah. You got the celestial, terrestrial, and telestial or something, I think.
Yeah.
The, yeah.
I haven't heard the term since I was like 18, so I don't remember them. But yeah, there's different levels, and it's a little different than the typical. Yeah.
And you can baptize your loved ones on behalf. So if you're worried about somebody, Jonathan, you can bring them into the fold, I believe, right? Is that correct?
It's called Baptisms for the Dead, and it's, yeah, it's kind of creepy.
Yeah, well, of course, I agree with that. But
we have a lot of the Christian church has a lot of creepy ideas. That's definitely true.
Yeah.
So, Ariel, help me understand how you help people heal from, someone comes to you and says, hey, I would love your help. How do you help them deconstruct and heal?
So initially we would do a meditation where we explore where they have the biggest fears still residing within their subconscious and in their bodies, and highlight the most important ones, what they want to work on the most. And then we meet weekly, and I teach them how to track emotions and process them, run them through an example, and then we will continue to do so as they come up in our sessions. But also they can follow a worksheet that if they come up with one, or if something rises in their body while we aren't meeting, they can kind of jot it down and process through and see if they can get any insight on their own. And then when we meet, I also have lessons planned for the analytical reasons of why of the actual concepts within Christianity that manifest as physical or mental dis-ease in the body. And so we follow a little bit of neuroscience, psychology, anatomy, and really get down to the technical terms so that you can learn with your analytical mind why this makes sense, and then also be following along somatically so that we can actually release the programs that are still there.
So help our listeners understand the differences between those two.
So analytically, we can know something all day long in our cognitive, our prefrontal cortex in our mind, and we could study a book and we can know something's true. But until we've actually made our subconscious agree with that, our body's going to have a chemical reaction when we hear anything that opposes it. So if you continue to be triggered by something when you hear it, it means that some part of you still on some level might agree with it or have some unresolved trauma around the concept. And I was trying to think if I had an example at the top of my head of something that I had processed recently, but nothing is coming up to share. So you can know something cognitively, but on a tissue level, you have to teach the subconscious first and then release whatever stored emotions are stored in the tissues, the fascia, and actually release it from the body as well.
And so how does that come out in the body? How does someone know they've released those types of elements in
the fascia? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
I love the detail of what you're presenting.
Yeah. So sometimes, like, if you know what the fascia is, it's a bioelectric conduit, the connective tissue in the body. It's that spider webby stuff. If whatever is in the body has a layer of it, it connects everything. And energy in the body is emotion. So it travels through the fascia. And when something is too overwhelming for normal function to keep going as it should, then proteins surround that and trap it in the fascia. And then the fascia gets tighter and tighter as we get older and we don't work through these things. And that's kind of one of the reasons for stiffness and, you know, uptightness and certain beliefs. And so that's why in yoga, sometimes you'll be deep in a stretch and there'll just be tears. And we're like, why am I crying? We're like, it doesn't matter. It's okay. Just let it go, you know, like let it flow. If we were even walking through something, we don't have to be stretching. We could be walking through an emotion, walking through a memory and touching it. If we can hold it for the allotted amount of time to release it, you could feel tingly, like a release, like a internal somatic shift of I just say like lightness, and you'll kind of feel it moving through the body. Oftentimes tears will come if you have a new perspective on something, like, oh my God, I've been thinking this way this whole time because of this one incident when I was 5 years old. And it's just mind blowing. Sometimes you'd cry tears of joy, sometimes tears of sorrow for that part of you that went through that. But mostly a somatic shift, sometimes emotions flow, sometimes, I mean, all kinds of emotions can come with it, chills, Yeah.
Now, was this also done through a certified myofascial therapist? Because I've actually had that done where they're stretching and it's not a fun, like a little sweetest massage, right? There's like stretching and then there's this like level of emotion. I actually did like, I was like teary. I didn't even know what the hell was going on, but she said, that's good. Right. And it's like, but is that what you were doing? Or was this is not necessarily a certified myofascial therapist. This is like walking through process. You're holding that sense, that area, or you're doing the yoga and it's just going through those normal processes. Or do you have to be intentional about it? Do you work with somebody when you're doing it, or is it happening on your own recognizance?
So it can happen under your own cognizance, and then you can do it through, there's so many different modalities that do this. Like that's why my fascial release happens. And, I was blending it with another thing. What's another thing I've done? I don't know. I've done so many things now. I'm blending the names together, but yeah, you can do them through the physical therapies with somebody who's certified in those things. You can do it through stretching. You can do it through meditation. You can do it through a clairvoyant healer can host something for you, or you can talk your way through things with a step-by-step process. There's also EFT tapping to help rewrite the belief, but yeah, that you could, there's so many ways to do it. It's actually so fascinating.
Ariel, do they know yet biologically or chemically what causes the proteins to stay in rapid? Is that like the biological response to fight or flight saying, okay, protect it at all costs? Or do they know what causes the proteins to do that? If you don't, it's okay.
No, all I know is that on that aspect, not any more chemically than what I said, just to make sure that normal function can continue. But but more than that, no, I don't know.
Okay. Because I would imagine that's where a lot of our inflammation comes from, are those protein buildups. Mm-hmm. Because I think what most people suffer from is reaching a point in their life, especially midlife and later, is where you're just like, okay, I'm good now at ignoring the shit.
Yeah.
You know, and you can get to where, and all of a sudden you've gained 30 pounds going, I wonder why. You know, it's like, it's easy to transition into that mindset of just, ignorance is sometimes bliss. It's not, but it feels like it because you don't have to feel the negative effects as much by ignoring them.
Well, not until it builds up and then manifests as a physical impairment.
Exactly. So. And your body's like, fuck you. We're going to deal with this. Yeah.
It's like a lot of people the body whispers.
Yeah. It's like, and sometimes I think the body shouts through what is almost feels like self-sabotage, where it's like, why the hell did I do that? Because that's my body telling me that I've got to deal with this. Your body won't let you keep it forever. Mm-hmm. And if you're not listening, if you're ignoring it, your body is going to do something that's going to get your attention. So part of your...
Can we hit stop and save? I'm down to a sliver and I don't want to make sure.
So if we lose you, we'll just deal with it in the recording. Okay.
Awesome.
Ariel, I wanted to ask, because it's an essential part of what I believe is, have you ever heard of Dr. Hawkins' consciousness scale?
I don't think so.
Okay. So in it, it's a scale of 0 to 1,000 that measures the frequency of your body at any point. And 0 to 200 are all negative experiences, and 200 is courage. What do you think, looking back, gave you the courage to take that risk with your coach? Because his theory is that once you get over it, courage, the rest is all positive. And it seems like that was really a pivotal point where you stop and dealt with the stored negative energy, and it really had a profound effect. But what is it that made you finally say, I've got to deal with this? Because I think that's what a lot of people are really struggling with in life is, how do I develop the courage to finally deal with this?
It began when my daughter was born, and I refused to give her the mindsets that I had developed and I had grown up with. And from then on, it was, we're going to do it, what it takes, no matter how hard it is. But it was definitely not linear and all positive experiences from there. Right. There was a very,
it never is. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of ups and downs, but always worth it.
I think it's great. I mean, Jonathan, you know, this is the chicken or the egg, right? We get to a place where we basically say we fake it till we make it, right? And we're like, okay, because I dug down inside. I'm saying the words. I'm a millionaire, or I've overcome this hurdle. And you're projecting that, even though you don't really believe it necessarily. We think there's even magic in that, but to have an external catalyst, I think that that's also true. That's the thing we talk about. Do we create our own existence, our own experience? And to me, when we look at Neo in the Matrix, I believe that he was always looking for something, but Morpheus came in and helped him. I thought Morpheus was the
person. Trinity revealed it too.
Well, that's true. But Morpheus was looking for him, and Trinity with the love connection made him know what was going on. It was still external to him. And that's why I like your story, because and maybe you'll go back in time and you'll see something and happen that in your own mind that made that, and you can cause your own self to be the person that did that instead of your daughter. But I still like believing that, right? I still believe that there's guardian angels, there's the divine that wants to help us, whatever it is in the cosmos, right? That I think it's helping us to become more awake right now. I don't know if you've talked to people who feel like they're waking up a little bit, they're looking around and they're saying, okay, this is a little bit of a shell here. I'm friends in the church, or things you've been told by the government, people are starting to wake up and see this, right? And I don't know if that's something cosmic that's doing it, or it's just it's something internal. And Jonathan, I think you're still always under the belief we create our own destiny, if you would, right? Do you believe in externalities to kind of come in and help out? Or do you believe that we cause our own, you know, deity, if you would?
Let me answer it a different way. Viktor Frankl wrote in his book, Night, it's one of the most amazing books I've ever read. He says, the people who survived Auschwitz were those who created a catalyst outside of themselves. Because I think in the moment of death and suffering, or death and chaos, we don't often know how to fight for ourselves, but it's easier to fight for someone we believe is worth loving. And so we project it outward because we don't know how to do it inward. And by projecting it outward, we develop enough courage to do it and then eventually turn it back on ourselves. And I think that's what you did, Ariel, is you saw it in your daughter and said, well, because I asked the same questions. I learned to love my kids before I learned to love myself.
Yeah.
But by loving my kids, I realized maybe I could love myself. Yeah. And that was my trajectory. And I think yours seems similar, is you found the love for your daughter was real. I don't know if you then turned it back, but I'm sure, I mean, when did it sort of click in for you?
I think within the few months of her being alive and always staring at her and watching this innocent thing and how pure she was, and that the only way the ways of the world were going to sneak in and hurt her was through me. And knowing that in those moments, I knew that everything needed to be questioned.
Love it.
That's awesome. So, we're going to close the show, but and Rich, I'll give you a chance to ask a final question. Ariel, if you were to meet someone and they just wanted sort of a meaningful reason to begin the deconstruction process, what would you tell them?
I think that they would know. And only they could decide if that was the process they were ready for. So I could never convince someone to take that step. It's just a knowing somatic that something's not okay and I want it to be okay. And I'm allowed to be okay. I'm allowed to be well.
Yeah. I guess my question would be, do you think there's hope for Christianity and or organized religions, or does it have to be totally deconstructed and some kind of new process needs to take place? What's your opinion in terms of knowing what you know and what we've talked about today? What's the best path forward, I guess?
Eliminating the rules, of spirituality. I mean, that they've applied it through religion. The only way you get to your own path of free exploration is through the freedom of choice and the ability to follow the intuitive drive. And we can't do that if we're following any mainstream head guru or priest.
Ariel, here's how I would say it, because I'm thinking, I want to say it exactly what you said in a different way, which is all the church has to do if it wants to get serious is embrace the reality of how far grace goes. Because what grace does is it completely obliterates it. It says there's only one law, and that's the law is love you and everybody else. That's it. You follow that, you get all the freedom, but all the responsibility. And so, Ariel, I love that. I think that was a fantastic way to end. You have been a fantastic guest. Thank you for coming on. I wish you the absolute best in what you're doing to influence people to begin the deconstruction process, because we're not asking people to give up. We're asking people to give up the worst of what they has kept humanity down. And I think you're way ahead of a lot of people. So I wish you the very best. Rich, any final words?
No, I have a pleasure wishing you the best in your journey. And let's hope for healing going forward. This country needs it a lot. The world does. And we need better voices. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
All right. This has been another fantastic episode of Living in the Matrix. I want to thank Ariel for joining us. Rich, thank you. Hope everyone has a wonderful weekend. It's hot out there. No matter where you're at, it seems like heat's everywhere. So have a wonderful weekend. Much love, everybody.
So let's get started.